Welcome into a special episode of Calling It, recording Tuesday, December 22nd, just past noon Eastern time. I'm Alex Barth, joined by Alex Lebowitz. We are going to get right into the show today. It is our NBA preview. The NBA kicks off tonight, tips off tonight, I guess both. You have the Celtics start on Wednesday, the first pre-bubble action. And it feels, even though we had the bubble, I have to say it feels like really like basketball is back. The bubble sort of felt like its own thing. You're going to have arenas, road trips, a full schedule, yada, yada, yada. So to break it all down, we have, he covers the Celtics and the NBA for Forbes, is Chris Grenham, former colleague of mine at CLNS Media. Chris, how you doing today?
Thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it. How you guys doing?
Doing well. It's nice that we're in winter. You know, it's felt weird that it's winter and there's no basketball. Now there is. We had the preseason games, which was a nice touch, and I want to start there. My biggest takeaway from the preseason games, Chris, and tell me if I'm off base here, was that Tristan Thompson is going to be monumentally important to this Celtics team.
Yeah, Tristan Thompson's going to be really important. I mean, honestly, all of the injuries that the Celtics are dealing with right now are going to create issues right away. And I need to make abundantly clear, the Celtics are a good team, and they're going to make the playoffs, and if they're healthy when they enter the playoffs, they'll be able to make a good push, but they're going to have problems early in the season because they just don't have any depth. And yeah, Tristan Thompson is one of those guys who they really need, and he probably won't start, but he's going to play a really big role in that front court and kind of the big man, the tough big man, the guy who's going to help on the glass that they've been looking for a lot in years past. And now they have him. His status for opening night is still up in the air. He's been practicing pretty well in the last couple of days, but still up in the air. But yeah, I totally agree. He's going to be important for that front court, and they're going to need as many guys back from injury as they can because they're short when it comes to depth right now.
And even when you have, you know, Kemba Walker back, you have Tristan Thompson back, there weren't a ton of changes going into this season, and obviously a shortened offseason. How much of the Celtics' success will depend on guys like Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown making that jump that people have expected them to make, and rightfully so?
Yeah, all of it. All of the success is going to rely on those two guys, really. And it seems pretty drastic, but this team goes as far as Jason Tatum takes them, especially at the beginning of the year, because it's a grim outlook, but they don't really have any other creators per se besides Tatum. Jaylen Brown's great. He's a good complementary player, but he doesn't have the offensive creation that Jason Tatum does. If Jaylen Brown can make that jump as a playmaker, you know, make that jump with the ball in his hands, that he's progressed nicely over the last couple of years, but they're going to need him to be that playmaker in the half court if they want to really have a nice offensive burst without Kemba Walker earlier in the year. Jaylen Brown thrives in transition. He doesn't necessarily thrive without Jason Tatum on the floor in the half court. And so Jason Tatum is going to pull this team along. The issue with the Celtics is, how do you manage those non-Tatum minutes? So you're 100% right. This team goes as far as Tatum takes them and as Brown progresses. You know, if Tatum can continue to take another leap forward, if Brown can take another leap forward, then yeah, it's going to minimize a lot of those problems because they're two immensely talented guys. But it really does come down to Tatum and how the Celtics manage those non-Tatum minutes.
So let me ask you this then, because I saw you wrote about this, and people can check out your latest column. I know you wrote it last night, this morning, at Chris Grenham on Twitter, kind of about what you just talked about and the Celtics' lack of depth and getting Tatum help. Who on the roster, and we'll take Jaylen Brown out of it for a second, outside of him, who on the roster do you think with a surprising surge could make Tatum's life easier? Who has the best chance to kind of emerge as that third guy and take some of the responsibility off Tatum's shoulders?
Well, that's an interesting one because they're going to turn to Marcus Smart quite a bit. And he mentioned yesterday following practice that the Celtics and himself included, they're focused on his shot selection. As you guys know, in the past, his shot selection has been a little questionable, especially when he starts to heat up. But if he can manage that shot selection a little bit better, it's going to really come down to Smart because they're going to need his offensive production. Going back to my last answer, there's not a whole lot of creation on this team, and they're going to struggle on the offensive end. They're a defensive-minded team, but if you can get a guy like Smart to manage that shot selection and produce along the perimeter and create a little bit, both as a playmaker and as a scorer, that's going to go a long way. So to be that third guy, you know, that would go a really long way for this offense if Marcus Smart can be that consistent third contributor on offense, because beyond him, again, it gets really, really slim. You saw Javonte Green start in both preseason games, and he doesn't really bring all that much on offense. Yeah, he's great in transition because he's extremely fast and ridiculously athletic, but you really put him in the starting lineup to balance out that defense. You look for his defensive versatility to be his main weapon that he brings to that you know, lineup. So you're not really looking for him to contribute all that much offensively. So you're relying on Marcus Smart because you can't really rely on much else. You hope that some of the young guys like Neesmith and Pritchard can contribute off the bat, because you don't really know exactly what you're going to get from Jeff Teague at this point.
Okay, so you mentioned the rookies, and I want to go there. I think there's a ton of expectations for these guys. There's a ton of excitement, I should say, around these guys within the fan base. And unlike recent years where the Celtics have kind of buried rookies, it seems like they're going to need to play with Gordon Hayward obviously gone and some of the injuries. What's the realistic expectation for Neesmith and Pritchard this year, especially early?
Yeah, you kind of nailed it. It's not a normal Celtics rookie situation. Brad Stevens doesn't really like to throw rookies right into the fire right away, and he's pushed away from that in years past. He doesn't really have a choice this year because of that lack of depth. So we saw some nice stuff from Pritchard and Neesmith in the preseason. Pritchard's first game against the Sixers was much more appealing than his game against the Nets. Both of the rookies against the Nets, they got tossed in the third quarter and early fourth quarter against the Nets starters. I mean, the Nets are one of the best teams in the NBA, so suddenly you've got two rookies in their second pro game playing against Durant and Kyrie Irving and Spencer Dinwiddie, like a really, really good team. So temper, you know, some of those results, because that was an interesting situation for those guys. But I think Pritchard was a good pick because he's a guy who can come in and run the offense for short stints, especially if there's injuries, especially if you run into foul trouble with a guy like Teague. Pritchard is their best point guard option behind Jeff Teague, and for my money, it's not even close. I like Tremont Waters, but Pritchard brings more on the defensive side of the ball just because of his size. I don't really think right now Carson Edwards is even an NBA player. He just hasn't shown any progress at all, and so you can't rely on him. So you're going to look for Pritchard to come in and run the offense for short stints. And again, he's a four-year guy. He's not your typical rookie in years past. You know, you got a lot of guys coming out after 1 or 2 years. Pritchard is in better shape to do that than most rookies. Neesmith is the floor spacing shooter that the Celtics have looked for in the last couple years. And he really plays his tail off. Like, you saw a lot of that in the first two preseason games that he had, the only two preseason games that he had. And I think that's going to go a long way because, yeah, he'll be a floor spacer and he can shoot the lights out, particularly off the catch. But that energy off the bench that he brings and playing his butt off, like, that's going to go a really long way for a team that doesn't really have much depth at all. So look for Neesmith to kind of come in, crash the boards like a madman, especially in some of those smaller lineups that you're going to need him to play a little bit bigger. And he's going to be able to shoot and he's going to be able to space the floor. And so you hope that both of those guys can contribute off the bat because, again, the Celtics desperately need it. But I like the upside with both of those picks.
And you mentioned the concerns with depth, which is going to play, you know, a huge role into this season. But going back to the playoffs and going back to these first two preseason games, offensive consistency has been a huge problem for the Celtics, whether it's turning the ball over or poor shot selection. It just seems like that's been one of the major factors in why they haven't gotten to where people think they should be. At what point does that come back onto Brad Stevens, and how big is this season for him from a job security standpoint?
Yeah, job security, I wouldn't be concerned. I think, you know, the organization has a really good thing going with Brad. I know the front office loves him. He has a good relationship with the hierarchy there. So I don't think job security is really a concern for Brad. I don't think, you know, they say they have a disappointing season. I don't think it immediately puts him on the hot seat quite yet. But that offensive inconsistency is certainly a problem. And you saw it in the two preseason games. They go to that, you know, that ISO ball that you saw a lot of it for bad stints against the Miami Heat in the playoffs last year. And, you know, that stagnant offensive repetition, I guess you could say, it ends up and results in a reliance on the three, which turned into some ugly, ugly shooting in the first two preseason games. I think they shot like 22% from deep. So you look for those stagnant possessions to be minimized. And yeah, some of that does come down to Brad, but you have to look at the situation that Brad is in right now. He doesn't really have a lot to work with. He's basically put in a position where, okay, yes, when Jason Tatum is out there, your team is probably going to be okay on the offensive end. When he's not, well, you got to patch it together because it could be pretty ugly. And so it's a tough spot. And so you do, I think, have to provide some context when saying, yeah, it comes down to coaching, because yes, it does, but he really doesn't have a whole lot of resources. And he's probably in one of the tougher spots he's been in the last couple of years, if not the toughest.
So let me ask you this here as we wrap up to the Celtics before we kind of look at the league as a whole. Are the Celtics the most interesting team in the league? And what I mean is, if you look at the gap between their potential floor and their potential ceiling where they could end up this year, do they have the biggest gap between their floor and ceiling of any team in the league?
That is a great question. I think it's hard to argue against the Golden State Warriors in that category. As far as the Eastern Conference goes, yeah, I mean, I think the Sixers are going to be better, but I think the Sixers have a pretty low floor too. There's a lot of interesting teams in that category this year solely because of the circumstances, right? I mean, you got barely any preseason, you barely any training camp, barely any offseason, and you're just jumping right in. So the room in between the ceiling and the floor for a lot of these teams is pretty ridiculous. The Celtics definitely included, because if Jason Tatum takes a leap again, if Jaylen Brown takes a leap again, well, they'll probably be fine on offense. And they're one of the better defensive teams in the league as far as I'm concerned. So yeah, that ceiling and floor disparity is pretty massive with the Celtics. But I would probably take the Warriors just because so much could rely on Steph Curry and if he can carry that team. And if he can't carry that team, well, you talk about depth issues. I mean, that could get really ugly really fast in a very good Western Conference. So I would probably take the Warriors there, but the Celtics for sure are in that conversation.
How many games did James Harden play for the Rockets this year?
Oh man, I think the Rockets are willing to get really uncomfortable. It's only a matter of time until he goes to Philly.
Like, well, I mean, how much more uncomfortable? He's throwing balls at teammates, isn't he?
He's throwing balls at Jason Tate. Yeah, it's already getting pretty ugly. I don't know. I mean, we saw it get really uncomfortable with Jimmy Butler and Minnesota. I think that took about a month into the season for them to move on from him. I don't really know. In my opinion, I think the Rockets are just waiting for a little bit more leverage. I mean, his contract situation helps because it's not like he's a free agent next year. And so then they're just really trying to sell off to get anything. So they have a little bit more leverage, but that's a tough situation because I don't know how much better the packages are going to get from Philadelphia. And at some point you do just have to move on. And if you're the Sixers, I mean, running it forward with James Harden and Joel Embiid, if you're Daryl Morey, you got to give that a run. You got to give that a shot. And so I don't know how many games he plays, but it's only a matter of time. He's definitely getting traded. It's just a matter of when. But so you think, for all I know, it could move into the trade deadline. I really don't know. I have no idea.
So you think the Nets are out of it, based on what you're saying?
I don't think the Nets are going to go get him. I don't think their package is as appealing. I don't think they have as much to offer as Philly does. And I also just don't think it makes as much sense for Brooklyn. I mean, Brooklyn has a lot of egos in that locker room, and that was concerning for me when I looked at their team a couple weeks ago. Looking at it again and looking at some of their numbers from last year and watching them live the other night, I mean, that's a really, really good team. And I don't really think James Harden going in there and screwing up that offensive flow makes a whole lot of sense for that front office. I just think Daryl Morey's going to make more of a push than Sean Marks and co. in Brooklyn.
And you talk about that Nets team, arguably the most talented and deepest team in the NBA. But, you know, obviously the elephant in the room are those egos. You can talk about Kevin Durant, but really it comes back to Kyrie Irving, who's had his issues at pretty much every team he's been on. Do you expect the Nets to be able to hold it together, assuming everyone stays healthy, from an ego standpoint? Because talent is not going to be the concern for them. Maybe health is. But do you think Kyrie can keep it under wraps? And you know, do you think they'll be able to play as well as, you know, they look on paper?
You know, a couple weeks ago, about a month ago, I probably would have told you no, and I don't think it's going to go well. But I've really changed course again. Like I was saying, it just looking at that roster, looking at that coaching staff, I do think they're going to be able to hold it together because it's not your typical coaching staff. You have Steve Nash running the show, who better than anyone understands the egos within a locker room and essentially how to relate to them. And you have Amari Stoudemire on the staff. You have Mike D'Antoni, who dealt with a lot of big egos in Houston. It's the right crop of people to really make this thing work. And I think the guys they have around Durant and around Irving just make a lot of sense for that team. Guys like Joe Harris, Spencer Dinwiddie, like it's a good crop of guys. If you can convince Caris LeVert that coming off the bench is the right thing to do, maybe play that, you know, Ginobili type role, things could go really, really well. And it's a different situation than when Kyrie was in Boston. Kyrie's in Boston. You have guys like Jalen and Jason who had just made a deep playoff run. You know, they were progressing at a great point in their career where they felt they deserved almost equal footing around Kyrie, and Kyrie probably didn't feel the same way because they were still the young guys. That was a bit of a complicated spot. I think with Durant and the guys they have around Kyrie and the coaching staff that they have, which is a unique one, you know, Jacques Vaughn is another guy there. I think they are going to be able to manage it. And I really do think the Nets are going to be a good team. And I was a doubter, like I said, a month ago, but I really do think this team is supremely talented. And I think they have the right mix of players and coaches to kind of manage those egos in Brooklyn.
So this year's draft was a little weird in that I feel like in the past there's been, you know, two or three superstar players and you kind of know how it's going to shake out. We didn't know, for the most part, who the number one pick was going to be until the night of the draft. And it really felt like it was a lot of blindly shooting darts with such a kind of balanced and unknown, I guess, aren't quite the right words. But with this rookie class, in terms of the players, in terms of the fit, where guys landed, who are you looking at to have the biggest impact this season?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you're right. There isn't a whole lot of crazy, crazy star power. LaMelo Ball is probably the most exciting player in this class. He was my favorite guy in the group. But again, you talk about ceiling and floor disparity. I mean, his floor is pretty, pretty low and his ceiling is absurdly high, probably as high as anyone in the class. So in terms of excitement, LaMelo Ball is the guy to watch. James Wiseman's impact in Golden State could definitely be interesting because that's a team that's going to need some depth guys to step up, some young guys to step up. So he could make a big impact. But a guy like Denny Avdija, who I wasn't all that high on, landed in D.C. with a pretty talented roster from an offensive standpoint. Like, he could really complement Russell Westbrook and Bradley Beal well, so I keep an eye on him. Tyrese Haliburton fell to 12 to Sacramento. He's probably one of the most talented guys. I don't even want to say talented. One of the most NBA-ready guys in this class. He's just so smart. And so in terms of my favorite guys, he's certainly up there, and I think he's a guy to keep an eye on. But there's a lot of guys deep in that class. Like, Josh Green has looked really good for the Mavericks, and the Mavericks are going to be ridiculously good offensively, and he's going to get some significant time because he's a plug-and-play guy. So Josh Green is another guy. There's a lot of guys deep into that class to keep an eye on, but I think Tyrese Haliburton, Josh Green, and Denny Avdija are some fun guys to watch.
All right, Chris Grenham covers the Celtics and the NBA for Forbes. Before we let you go, because we love putting people on the spot, what's your finals pick?
Oh, my finals pick, I will go Lakers over the Nets is my finals pick. I don't see anyone beating the Lakers. They got better, and they were already very good last year, and they've only gotten better. So they're my pick.
All right, so again, Chris Grenham covers the Celtics and the NBA for Forbes. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris Grenham. He's got post up right now dealing with kind of the Celtics depth issues like we talked about earlier in the segment. Go check it out. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time, and enjoy basketball being back.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
So basketball is back. There you have it with Chris Grenham. Lebowitz, are you excited? You excited for the Celtics? Or are you nervous?
I'm nervous. I'm not nearly as excited as I was going into last season. And you know, part of that is because of the shortened off season, and you know, how much can you really accomplish from a player standpoint, like on your roster, how much can they improve during a short off season? Number one. And number two, what moves can you really make? And Brad Stevens bringing in Thompson, it's a big move. I'm not, you know, discounting that completely, but that's not a complete game changer. So I alluded to it in my question to Chris. It comes down to Jason Tatum making that jump from star to superstar. And if he does that, I'll feel a lot better. But overall, the inconsistencies on offense are a cause for concern. And, you know, I think unless Danny Ainge makes a move midseason to upgrade this roster, the Celtics team is not going to do, you know, that much this season relative to what they've done in years past.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, and I kind of alluded to it when I was asking about Tristan Thompson. And I know you can't, the preseason games aren't the perfect way to evaluate it, but Robert Williams doesn't look like he made a jump. You want to talk about player jumps? He kind of looks like the same guy. That's concerning. The team needed size. Thompson was their answer to that. If he can't play, and then obviously you don't know what's going to happen with Kemba, and they're playing every other night for 5-6 months. Is he only going to play 40 games? I think it could get ugly. I don't think it will. I don't think it will get ugly. I think it'll be tough at times, but it could definitely get ugly. Speaking of ugly, we have to talk about, and there's a lot of NFL stuff we want to do in terms of the Patriots being eliminated and the Bills winning the division and all of that. But the reality is those things will still be true for the next couple of weeks. We will dig into the playoffs, et cetera. The big story really in the NFL this week to me was the New York Jets. And they lose to the Rams, and now I don't want to say they lost out on Trevor Lawrence, because the Jaguars still play the Bears, and I don't trust the Bears to win a game they're supposed to win. I don't know if you do, Lebowitz.
No, that's a winnable game for the Jags. I think that's the only saving grace for Jets fans right now.
It's Mitchell Trubisky, whatever, but oh my God, are Jets fans losing it? I saw Jake Asman, friend of the show, tweeted that there's no way, and I don't know if he was being sarcastic or not. I never saw him follow up.
He was. I actually asked him about it. It was a sarcastic tweet.
Because he had tweeted that Lawrence will pull an Eli and refuse to go to Jacksonville when a month earlier he berated somebody for asking him if Lawrence would pull an Eli and refuse to go to the Jets. So the Jets fans are broken. Let me say this. I see people say, why would the Jets do that? Why would Adam Gase win that game? Tanking doesn't happen at the player personnel level. It just doesn't, right? The analogy I love to use is look at the movie Major League, right? Yeah. The owner, whatever her name is, I'm blanking on the name, but remember, she wants the team to lose so she can move them to Miami. So she puts the worst possible team together, but the players, the coaches, they want to win because they are, even if it's not in Cleveland, they are trying to get jobs elsewhere in baseball. They're playing to put out good tape, a good scouting report, etc. They are not in on the tank. That is what tanking really looks like. The movie Major League is the perfect example of that.
Yeah.
Adam Gase wants a job next year. All these players want jobs next year. They're going out and trying to win. So to say why would the players do it, I think is missing the point, as hilarious as that all was.
Yeah, and I think the Jets actually have a cardboard cutout of Chris Johnson, and they remove a panel. Unfortunately, they only are showing, you know, his right shoulder right now.
Yeah,
I want a few more games to get him completely nude. So that was a failed initiative to inspire the players. But anyway, yeah, the players aren't going to try to lose. The coaches aren't going to try to lose. That said, that Raiders game seemed like they were trying to lose. When you bring the house on, you know, a third and long,
yeah,
you know, with 4 seconds left in the game, when you're up by 3 points or whatever it was, I mean, I don't know how you don't just put everybody back and make sure that someone doesn't catch it in the end zone. But that happened, and I guess we can boil it down to incompetence. But yeah, they're not going to try to lose. I mean, it's not why would they? Well, Adam Gase knows he's out of a job at the end of the season. There's no incentive for him to try to tank to get Trevor Lawrence, because he would never coach Trevor Lawrence unless the Jaguars pick him up as their head coach or offensive coordinator next season. So that would be incredible. Maybe you could, you know, bring up some tampering allegations if that were the case.
Well, I mean, that would be incredible. I didn't even think of that. If Gase, because those are the teams that hire Gase, and I don't think they're right, but the teams with young quarterbacks that want to develop are the ones that hire him. Mm-hmm. He could potentially win that game against the Rams, which gets the Jaguars Trevor Lawrence, and then become their offensive coordinator. I don't think that's a stretch. That's incredible.
I think it is a stretch only because he was such a horrendous coach this season.
Yeah.
Maybe he is an offensive coordinator, but if you've seen what he's done to Sam Darnold, who I think is a lot better than, you know, how he has played and how he's
shelled himself right now.
It's really sad to watch. I don't know how you look at that and say, yeah, I want this guy, you know, coaching our next superstar quarterback, you know, the most highly touted guy since maybe Andrew Luck or whatever. But I don't know how you could do that. I don't think Adam Gase has a job next year. If he does, it might be an OC someplace. It might be called the collegiate level. But the point being, they're not going to try to lose any games. And I think you can boil down that loss to Sean McVay's poor strategy. Jake Asman has been saying it all week since that game. I don't know how you don't exploit that Jets secondary. And they just didn't really make much of an effort to do that, despite having a great wide receiving core and the Jets having the worst secondary in the NFL. So it's just, it's crazy. It's very New York Jets. I'm ecstatic that this is the case. I think it's hilarious. And now Jets fans have to struggle, you know, with the realization that, one, they're not going to get Trevor Lawrence. And two, you know, is Sam Darnold still your guy? Do you trust another coach coming in and salvaging what's left of him? Or are you going to try to get that kid from BYU or that kid from Alabama? Are you going to try to bring in a rookie quarterback? There are a lot of decisions to be made.
I would say Ohio State too, Fields.
Or Fields, yeah, that him as well. Now they have this dilemma, and all that hope that they had, you know, this season, finishing, you know, going into every game horrendously unprepared and horrendously under talented, it's not paying off, which is a nice thing. You shouldn't be, you know, if you suck, you suck, and that shouldn't be incentivized completely.
Well, I will say too, leave it to the Jets where. On the day the Patriots are eliminated from the playoffs for the first time in over a decade, the Jets still managed to make their own fan base more miserable than the Patriots fans. Even on what is arguably the darkest day the Patriots have had in over 10 years, Jets fans were more miserable than Patriots fans.
Over a win. My hope, my joke, I've been using this one ad nauseum. I send my condolences to all Jets fans. I'm sorry for your win instead of I'm sorry for your loss. That's how it is. It's like it's funny how it's a win that's causing that fan base to be so miserable. I also find it rich that like Mekhi Becton and you know, Adam, they're coming out being like, you should want us to win. You should like be happy that we won. 1-15. There's no difference between that and 0-16. The only difference is you don't get the guy.
That's a huge difference. You can't say there's no difference.
There's no difference from a confidence standpoint or from a pride standpoint.
I think there is.
Do you think there's a difference between 0-16 and 1-15 from a pride standpoint? I think both are horrendous.
Especially neither is great, but especially if the win's late in the year, I think. You know, there's a lot of bad teams who said, you know, teams that start bad, they get knocked out of playoffs, but maybe they win like two of their last three. And players will talk about how that gives them momentum going into the next season. They feel like they found their footing. I guarantee you, if the Patriots win these last two games, you'll hear people talking about how that's positive momentum going into next season. And that's not total BS. I actually believe that. So I look, would they have been better off for the long-term history of their franchise losing that game? Absolutely. I think somebody pointed this out. It's easy to look at the worst loss in a franchise's history. It can be hard to pinpoint the worst win in a franchise's history. Such will likely not be the case with the New York Jets. But I, you know, again, good for the players and good for Mekhi Becton. They drafted him to be a dominant player. He played great in that game. He absolutely did. So good for him. No, I'm happy for him. I'm happy for those players. I really am. And they should criticize Jets fans. They absolutely should criticize Jets fans. They are all in the right for doing that. These fans, air quotes, have come out and basically called them the worst collection of talent in NFL history for the past 3 months. How would you feel about that if you were on that roster?
I mean, I would use that as motivation for sure. But if you if you only get one win out of that motivation, then it's
roster still is what it is. The roster still is what it is. Have you seen the conspiracy theory that Belichick let the Rams beat him? That Belichick let the Rams beat him so that they would lose to the Jets.
I have not, and I'm glad I haven't.
So basically, Bill said, we're not going to the playoffs. Hey, we'll give you this win, but we need you to lose to the Jets next week so we don't have Trevor Lawrence in the division. And McVay said, fine.
Yeah, I mean, that's great.
Greedy chess.
That's great fan fiction. I don't think there's much basis for it.
2020, man. Anything's possible.
That's fair. That's fair. It's been an odd year. More weird things have happened this year than that conspiracy, if it's true. So
well, there you go. The New York Jets. I don't know. Did you see the – I know you're not a huge SNL guy, but they did the Sportsmax sketch last week. Did you see that?
I don't think so, no.
They did. I'll send it to you. It's actually really good. You know what Newsmax is, right?
Oh, yeah.
They did a sports version of that about the Jets, and they opened their segment, the New York Knicks, 10 years of nothing but dominance.
That's
and then they have the New York Knicks, 100 years of greatness.
Those damn scoring machines. Right, exactly. China interfering.
Yeah. That's basically what it was. And who said the Jets won the game? The National Football League? Like, I'll send it to you. It was very good. But I keep thinking, the New York Jets, a decade of dominance. So we'll move on now. You are very excited. You texted me about this. You are fired up. We've run out of ideas for movies and TV shows. Okay. As a culture, as a society, as a human race, there's no more new ideas. They're all gone. Everything's a sequel or a reboot or a remake or whatever. And the latest movie to get that treatment will be Coming to America. And the sequel will also be called Coming to America, but the two is a number instead of a TO. And that's without a doubt going to confuse a ton of people.
Yeah, it's but like two. It's like Too Fast, Too Furious.
Yeah, that's a different name. It was Fast and Furious, then Too Fast, Too Furious. This is the same. Audibly, you cannot tell the difference between what I'm saying.
Yeah, isn't English dumb? They should probably just do Coming to America 2 or the sequel or something. But I'm sure that's going to be in the title. I'd be shocked if they just left it.
Coming to America 2, Electric Boogaloo?
Yeah, maybe that's what they'll call it. I wouldn't say I'm super excited. I'm very skeptical as to whether this is going to be good or not. You know, Dumb and Dumber did the same thing. Obviously, you had Dumb and Dumber. Then you had that one that wasn't affiliated with the original Dumb and Dumberer, which was about Harry and Lloyd when they were in high school, which was amusing, but it wasn't in that ballpark of the original. Then it did Dumb and Dumber 2, which was spelled T-O, that speak of the homophones.
Was it T-O or T-O-O?
I think it was T-O. Maybe it was T-O-O, but it was not T-W-O. So it was not that.
I'll look it up. Keep talking.
Anyway, it was brutal. I couldn't even get through the whole thing because it made me sad. Because they're trying to you
T-O,
know.
You're right.
They're trying to redo one of the funniest movies of all time, which cannot be topped by any comedy movie, let alone a sequel. Especially when the guys are 20 years older than they were in the original. Coming to America 2, I think this is definitely a more well-suited movie to do a sequel for. That said, it's 35-year gap between these two movies, and you know, I just don't think you can expect it to be anything too special. It's the original cast that's nice. Eddie Murphy, I like. Arsenio Hall, great. You know, I'm happy about that aspect of it, but you're trying to redo something that can't be redone. Coming to America, one of the best comedy movies of all time, in my opinion, along with Trading Places. Those two movies are great, great Eddie Murphy movies. I'm just really skeptical as to whether it can be good, and I'll probably end up watching it, but I don't think I'll like it. I really don't. I really don't. You can call me pessimistic about it instead of skeptical, I guess.
I mean, I that's essentially the take I had about the Breaking Bad movie. Was it the Breaking Bad movie or was one of them?
Breaking Bad, I forget. El Camino?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like, I'll watch it. I know I'm not going to like it, but I'll watch it.
I love that, though. I like the Breaking Bad thing because that was different. That was, you're talking about a drama, one of the best television series, I think the best television series of all time, which at the end of it.
Ooh, somebody hasn't seen Sopranos.
I have seen Sopranos. I think Breaking Bad is
How
much
can you say Breaking Bad? I love Breaking Bad.
Sopranos is so good. I'm only on season 3 of The Sopranos, it's supposed to be the peak, that 3 through 4. I think it's a great show. It's a good show. Breaking Bad.
Finish it, and then we'll have this discussion.
I will.
I don't want you to embarrass yourself.
I think a lot of people would agree with me. Breaking Bad, the total show, the package, the series as a whole, will never be top. Top to bottom, it was as consistent and good throughout as anything ever. People hated The Sopranos ending. No one hated the Breaking Bad ending. The only problem, back to my main point, the only problem with the Breaking Bad ending is it left a hole in Jesse's story. And what El Camino did was it put a bow on it. And it gave fans closure on what happened to him, but not in a forced way, at least in my opinion. So I love that movie. I thought it was great. I don't think they tried to do too much with it. I think they did just the right amount. But when you're doing a comedy, it's not as much about the plot as it's about how funny it is. And the story has to make sense too. I think the story makes sense, but I don't think guys who are 35 years older are going to be as funny as they were when the original was made. I just don't think it's possible. That said, Tracy Morgan's in it. Very excited for that. Wesley Snipes is in it. Leslie Jones is in it. So you have some additions who I think will absolutely add to the movie. And you're recreating the barbershop scene, which is an all-time classic. So I'll watch it. I'll probably laugh here and there. But there's no way, no chance in hell it comes even close to matching the original.
So I will say, and we talked about this off the air, I've never seen the original. I haven't seen Trading Places either. It is a pop culture gap. We all have them.
Yeah.
It is a pop culture gap of mine. Maybe I'll watch the original so I can see the sequel when it comes.
And I have a lot of those pop culture gaps as well. Not as much with comedies, but with a lot of classic, you know, dramas and with like Star Wars. I've never fully gotten into Star Wars.
Oh, what?
I've watched a couple of the movies. It's not for me. I like Lord of the Rings.
I've never seen Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, I think, is a lot better than Star Wars.
I have zero interest in Lord of the Rings.
It's you say that, you'll watch it, and you'll understand the hype. I was talking to my dad earlier. Deer Hunter, you probably haven't seen that either. It's a long one.
I don't even know what that is.
It's Christopher Walken. It's, you know, Fredo from Godfather, from The Godfather.
So, okay, you want another one? I've never seen The Godfather. Ugh, I've tried. I can't get through it. I can't. I don't have the attention span for it.
It's a long movie.
It's not like, give me Goodfellas, give me Scarface, give me blood on the screen in the first 5 minutes.
Never seen Scarface.
What?
I mean, Scarface isn't as big as Godfather.
It's so good though. It's somehow.
You like Al Pacino? You like Al Pacino?
I do. Okay, hang on. Here's the thing about. I think Scarface is the only movie you can say this about. You know the movies that are so bad they're good?
That's Scarface?
Kind of. Wait, so are you a fan of those movies, yes or no?
Not necessarily, no. Right.
So Scarface is simultaneously so bad it's good, while also being a really good movie.
And that's like, also, it's also Al Pacino being over-the-top Al Pacino, right, which so is that's arguably the best Al Pacino.
The acting is a little bit cheesy. Some of the effects, like the gun effects, the blood effects, are like pretty obviously fake, but it's full of classic moments. It's riveting. It's like, I always love it when I see a movie as an adult, right? We see these things parodied all the time in kids' shows growing up. And just in general, we see these things. You see things parodied, but you maybe never see where they're originally from. Like, Say Hello to My Little Friend.
Of course.
Fairly Odd Parents parodied that. Family Guy, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. I saw those parodies before I actually saw the movie. And it's really cool to see them in reality. Scarface has a ton of those moments.
And that's exactly like Godfather. What's the one? There's one where there's a scene in that where there's an Adam Sandler, an Adam Sandler movie in which he kisses somebody and he says, you know, you broke my heart. Or I know it was you and you broke my heart.
Is Al Pacino in God? I didn't think Al Pacino was in Godfather.
Al Pacino is the main character in Godfather.
I'm thinking of De Niro. I'm thinking of De Niro.
De Niro's also in Godfather. He's in Godfather too.
Right, but he's not in the original, right?
He's not in the original. But okay. If you want to see main point here, if you want to see Al Pacino's greatest performance and how great of an actor he is and how his character evolves, I only saw the first two because I was told not to even bother with the third, although I need to watch the third eventually. You gotta watch The Godfather though. Because Al Pacino,
like once a year. I can't do it.
You got to just power through and then get into the second one. And then you'll watch the second. You'll be like, okay, yeah, no, this is amazing. You have James Caan. You have Robert Duvall, Marlon Brando, Al Pacino.
It's too much talking for me. Like, yeah, I can see all those guys. Goodfellas, amazing cast, incredibly violent movie.
But the thing is, it's setting up for the violence. Like, you have to get through the first half of the movie, which is a lot of dialogue, a lot of building up tensions and whatnot, building up the plot. And then you start to see the transformation from Al Pacino's character and Michael Corleone.
Well, I'll tell you, Scarface, Al Pacino's character, total transformation, total character growth.
Yeah. And I bet the reason he got that role is because of what they saw from him in Godfather.
The other way around.
No, Godfather was well before. Al Pacino was young. He was a baby-faced kid in Godfather. He was far younger.
He was like 10 years earlier. You're right.
So, Al Pacino's great. But overall, Godfather, top five movie. Godfather 1 and 2. I'll put them together as a package deal. Top five movie of all time. Hence, easily.
I've heard that. I don't necessarily disagree with it. It's not my taste. It's like there's musicians that, like, I agree, like, are great. I get Lady Gaga. I get why people love Lady Gaga. I totally get it. I get she's supremely talented. It's just not my kind of music. I don't enjoy it. I have no problem with other people enjoying it. I'm not going to dispute them enjoying it. Doesn't do it for me. Doesn't float my boat.
You want to know one fun fact about Godfather or the director that I don't think anyone really knows, what was that?
Who's the director for Godfather?
His name's Francis Ford Coppola. So you probably heard the name.
Yeah, no, he's pretty famous.
His nephew. I mean, the Coppola family, his daughter's a very famous director. She directed like Lost in Translation, good movie, and other movies like that. His nephew is Nicolas Cage.
Okay, so give me a Godfather remake with Nicolas Cage. I will watch that. I will watch anything with Nicolas Cage. I got to tell you, it can be 2 in the morning, and I'm about to go to bed, and I'm just scrolling through the channels before I go to bed. If I see Con Air come up on AMC, I'm not going to bed till 5 in the morning.
You're a big Con Air guy.
I love the two movies I will always put on are Con Air and Armageddon. They are two of the worst movies ever made. They are fantastic.
So you really are a it's so bad, it's good.
Oh, yeah. Guy. Oh, have you ever seen Armageddon?
Of course.
Oh, it makes no sense. None of it makes any sense.
Yeah, what's easier to trade?
The entire stake of the movie, right? They keep saying, like, oh, this is so dangerous, we should turn back. And, like, Liv Tyler, right? Steven Tyler's daughter is the main female lead, and it's her father and her boyfriend or fiance or whatever. Right. And, you know, spoiler alert here, but the plot doesn't matter in Armageddon. You know, they're the ones up on the rock and she keeps going, no, don't tell them to do that. It's too dangerous. We're like, the whole point is if they don't stop the asteroid, it hits Earth and everybody dies. So them putting themselves in danger means absolutely nothing. They can either die on the rock or die 5 minutes later on Earth. The entire stakes of the movie are completely irrelevant. But Steve Buscemi dry humps a nuclear bomb, and I have to see that.
Well, it's also like, what's more realistic? Like, what's a better? And I think there's a comedian who has a joke about this. Like, what's the better alternative? Teaching a bunch of oil rig workers how to go up into space and destroy an asteroid, or having actual astronauts and scientists go up and do it. No sense.
There was that question was actually asked to Michael Bay, and he stopped it. He ended the interview. and the That's best so part funny. Is so like to add to just the lunacy of this movie, Deep Impact came out, I think, days later. It's with Morgan Freeman's in it, Robert Duvall, Elijah Wood. Deep Impact came out. Hang on, I have it right here. Deep Impact came out May 8th, 1998. It was a few months later. Armageddon came out July 1st. They're the exact same plot. An asteroid is coming to destroy Earth, and scientists have to stop it. But Deep Impact's like a really good movie. It makes sense. The acting is good. Armageddon is a complete mess, yet Armageddon is way more entertaining to watch because Ben Affleck is playing National Geographic, right, Planet Earth, with animal crackers on Liv Tyler's tits. It is – oh, my God. I love – and then we'll do another episode on Con Air because I have my Con Air rant too, which is fantastic. But the entire – I've never seen a movie – where the entire overarching stakes of the movie are rendered irrelevant by the plot itself. The entire time. It's not like it's a surprise. It's not like you find out it like in the last 5 minutes, oh, they were never in any danger at all. Well, Steve Buscemi was because he paid a bunch of hookers he couldn't afford. But the entire movie, they're like, oh no, this is dangerous. We should turn around. If you turn around, you die just 5 minutes later. Oh my God, I love it. I love Armageddon. I don't even remember where we started with this, but Billy Bob Thornton's in it. You know how Billy Bob Thornton plays like the redneck in every movie? But humble redneck. He's the head scientist for NASA in Armageddon.
That you're right. I forgot about that. That's the one departure he takes in his career from.
You know, you have Will Patton would be a great scientist. Michael Clark Duncan would be a great scientist. I think Keith David is in it, Keith David, I think, is the president, because Keith David always plays the president. But no, you have all these people who would make sense as the president, and they're like, nah, man, Billy Bob Thornton, let's do it.
He's the scientist. Yeah, and I mean, yeah, Billy Bob Thornton's the best when he's playing like Bad Santa or like the coach in the remake of Bad News Bears.
Right, that's who he is.
That's who he is. Deep down, that's who he is.
But no, they made him the head scientist for NASA.
Yeah, well, they also made Ben Affleck a guy who works at an oil rig, which also is not believable.
No, but that, I mean, he's played blue collar before.
He has. Like, Good Will Hunting, he is great in that.
Bruce Willis can play whatever he wants. Mm-hmm. You know, Will Patton's in that movie. Will Patton's a great, serious actor.
By the way, I don't know if you said, you may have already said this, Steve Buscemi, he's in both of those.
Yes, Steve Buscemi is in both Armageddon and another guy I will always watch.
Connor. Yeah,
Steve Buscemi is in Armageddon and Con Air, but you got to tell me when we're going over. I'm trying to wrap this up, but I keep going.
We're well over.
Okay, yeah. Last point. Will Patton, great, serious actor. Remember the Titans? He's fantastic. Billy Bob Thornton, a goofy, aw shucks kind of feel-good guy. Guess which one plays the goofy, aw shucks, feel-good second lead in Armageddon, and guess which one plays the head scientist for NASA? Go watch Armageddon. All right, I'm done. I'm done. Final thoughts. Go ahead.
It's a great movie. It's a bad movie. It's a very bad movie, but it's so bad. It's good.
It sucks. It's so good. That's how I like to describe it. It's so bad. It's fantastic.
But you like The Departed. You like Goodfellas.
The Departed is good. Wait, one more Armageddon point, because I'd be remiss if I didn't get this in, because this is what hooked me on this movie.
Please.
So at one point, like, they figure out that not everybody can make it home from the asteroid. They're going to blow the asteroid up at this point. So there actually are stakes now. This is the end of the movie. I don't care them giving away spoilers, because again, the plot is not the point of Armageddon. You watch it for bad acting and scenes that don't make sense. So they figure out somebody's not going to make it home. And Liv Tyler, who she's Bruce Willis's daughter and Ben Affleck's fiance or girlfriend or fiance, it changes during the movie. But, you know, she's like in the NASA control room for some reason. She's not a scientist. She's just there watching her father and boyfriend and 14 other people she doesn't care about openly probably die. And at one point, she just starts screaming. Like, they're like, oh no, like, this isn't working. We're going to have to leave somebody behind. And she just starts screaming. And somebody says, will you get her out of here? And she just goes, I have nowhere else to be. Oh my God, be anywhere else. They're trying to save the world. It's not about you not having anywhere else to go. It's about you shouldn't be here right now.
This is NASA. We don't care about you at all, let alone where you have to go.
To be fair, it's Billy Bob Thornton's NASA.
That's true. His NASA's different.
the spoilers are not important at all. The plot is not important because it doesn't make sense. Just go watch it. It's so bad. It's so bad. You will enjoy yourself. Oh, so bad. All right. Final thought. Go ahead.
I think we covered it. I'm not a huge Con Air guy. I'll watch it once in a while. It's funny. It's bad. Dave Chappelle, great in it, by the way. That's early Dave Chappelle before he was Chappelle's Show, Dave Chappelle. Armageddon. If I had to pick one, though, I'm a Con Air guy. Way over Armageddon.
I probably am, too, because Armageddon can drag at times, but... like, just us. So
but back stupid. To the main point, a movie that's so good, it's Godfather. Okay. And you have to get into it. I really think that you will not regret watching it. Both of them. I sat down and I watched both of them, not consecutively, but over the course of like a week or two. And it was well worth my time. And it's a movie that, you know, anytime it's on, I'll turn it on for a few minutes. So It's not just this hyped up thing. It's a phenomenal film, okay, worth watching. And I think that, you know, it's absolutely Al Pacino's best performance, like without a doubt, between 1 and 2, best performance. And you also get an appreciation for Marlon Brando. And that's the only movie I've really
ever
seen.
Brando. There's a section on the Armageddon Wikipedia page entitled Scientific Accuracy. And at the end of the credits, the filmmakers were forced to put this disclaimer. NASA's cooperation and assistance in this film does not reflect an endorsement of the contents of the film or the treatment of the characters depicted therein. So there you go. NASA had to publicly denounce it. That's probably the best endorsement, is NASA publicly denouncing it.
I did not realize that J.J. Abrams wrote the screenplay to NASA.
Armageddon. He had to flush all the bad ideas out before he became.
I guess so. The dude who did Star Wars also did Armageddon. What a pivot.
Ben Affleck says he once asked Michael Bay why it was easier to train oil drillers to become astronauts than it was to train astronauts to become oil drillers. Bay told Affleck, shut the fuck up. And that was the end of that.
And you know what? The alternative would have also been a good movie and probably would have been a better dramatic.
It would have been a better movie. I watched that movie.
It wouldn't be ridiculously goofy. It would kind of be like an Interstellar type of thing where, you know, you have this mission and the world depends on it, but you don't have a bunch of blue collar oil rig guys.
Well, no, what you'd have is you have a bunch of blue collar oil rig guys training these like Ivy League bougie astronauts. And at first they don't get along and then they become friends and they team up to save the Earth. Like, that would be a good movie.
It would be. Maybe they'll do a remake and make it a little bit more realistic.
I want the Armageddon sequel.
To bring it full circle, Armageddon sequel. We'll get Bruce Willis back out there. We'll get Ben Affleck back out there. The reality is most of those guys are probably too big to do another movie like that.
No, it was a big movie at the time.
You're right.
Bringing Bruce Willis back would be tricky, but I said it
grossed $550 million.
Yeah.
That's wild.
People paid $550 million to see that junk. Fantastic. Good luck, all right. Enjoy basketball, everybody. We'll be back next week. Football on the table, hockey on the table. The NHL figured things out. That's right around the corner. We'll have a NHL preview show coming at some point once the schedule is kind of more locked in. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at Collinet Podcast. Check us out online at clnsmedia.com. So here you go. Christmas. You want to avoid your family. Your viewing list: Godfather, Scarface, Armageddon, Con Air, and Coming to America. There you go. There's your
movie. And my favorite movie of the year, by the way, just since we're on, was Palm, the one with Andy Samberg. It's like a Groundhog's Day. So that's actually a legitimate request. Amazon Prime, I want to say, or maybe Apple TV, okay. Production is.
I actually have theories about this movie. I have theories about this movie. It's a How I Met Your Mother sequel, but we'll get into that another time. For Alex Lovewitz, I'm Alex Barr. Right. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.